morning. I've got a prop. Before he was a storytelling rabbi, Jesus, who I don't know what kind of props he used, worked as what the Greeks called a tekton, which means a builder in stone and wood. But some people have pointed out a problem with that story. If Jesus was a builder, a carpenter, or a woodworker, how come we don't find any references to this kind of work in his speech? We would expect some comments on living lives that are upright in the way that houses and furniture need to be, on keeping ourselves on the level, plumb and square. We would expect some comments about using well-seasoned wood that won't warp or crack, about working with the human grain, or at least having good reasons if we must sometimes work against it. We'd expect a stack of such wood-related comments, or at least a bundle, but all we can find is one log and one splinter. But he likes this prop, so he uses it several times. Why do you see the splinter that's in your brother's eye, but do not notice the log that's in your own eye? Or how can you say to your brother, let me take the splinter out of your eye, when there's a log in your own eye? You hypocrite, first take the log out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to take the splinter out of your brother's eye. Now, I suspect that these words about splinters and logs are not original with Jesus. They have a proverbial feel, don't they? He's reaching in for some old material. Such observations are the stuff of proverbs from around the world. Here's one from Japan. We see the 7 shortcomings of others, but overlook 10 of our own. And there's this one from Indonesia. We don't notice the elephant on our own eyelid, but can spot an ant on the other side of the sea. I like this Indonesian example for the way it almost whistles in wonder at these funny lenses that we wear. It's amazing how we so often see the ant, but miss the elephant, count the 7 while overlooking 10, reach for the splinter while ignoring the log. I see this or that in you and your actions. But when it comes to me, no, that's another story. It's not always easy to see ourselves while we scrutinize others, to look both ways as we cross amongst each other. I'll share some more about this in a few moments, but now let's sing again a perfect song for the new year, Morning Has Broken. What number is that? Number 38, I think. Oh. Our church sign was hit. I don't know if it was New Year's Eve or New Year's Day, but we arrived here to find our sign had been smashed down. On January 1st of 2009, I was hit by a car while on my morning walk, just 6 hours into that new year. I thought of talking about that in my 2010 New Year's sermon, but then thought better of it after hearing how our own Kay Scheidegger had been hit by a truck while crossing GWA in Richland. I'd walked home uninjured from my brush with a car. Kay wasn't so lucky. Just last night, before she left the potluck, she said, I'm in too much pain. I probably won't be there tomorrow. I don't know how much that is the injuries and how much of that is other stuff. So it's been a long, slow process of recovery for her. I had a little discomfort, and that was that for me in the car. Me and ladders are another story, but you've heard that one already. So I put the idea on the shelf, thinking, who am I to talk? Kay was clobbered by a log when all I got was a splinter. But as we've just heard in our quick tour of world proverbs, a splinter is at least as likely to occupy our attention as a log. And something about this one felt like it had gotten under my fingernail, as sometimes used to happen when I was a tekton doing woodwork. And something about how and where I got hit by a car on New Year's Day 2009 and what happened afterwards has remained under my fingernail ever since walking downtown at 5:30 a.m. to make a bank deposit. It was still quite dark, and I'd taken the precaution of wearing the very understated hat that I'm sporting today. Well, this hat has an interesting history. It's a campaign hat from when Reg Weaver ran for and won the presidency of the National Educators Association in 2002. My brother teaches computers at a community college and campaigned on Reg's behalf, and he made a gift of several of these hats to my family. The other two are fluorescent orange. I grabbed this one first. He's my brother, so. By the way, the 3.2 million member NEA is the largest union in the United States, formed by the 1966 merger of the National Teachers Association and the American Teachers Association, which was once called the National Association of Colored Teachers. The NEA was an early endorser of women's suffrage, the GI Bill, the Civil Rights Act, and bilingual education. So besides being a rather silly hat to look at, it also holds some dignity. It's all about making invisible people visible. And it's easy to see itself. Or so I thought. At 6 in the morning, I was on my way home from the bank, ready to cross one of Salem's most brightly lit intersections, right in front of our new downtown conference center. I had the green light and the walk signal in my favor, the little walking man guy, and in addition to the hat. But as I stepped off the curb, a car quickly rounded the corner and grazed me. The sides sort of levered me backwards, almost lifting me off my feet. And under the bright streetlights, I could see the driver's face looking right at mine. I shouted, "You hit me!" Just in case she didn't know that she had. I thought she'd roll down the window, I'd say something about being more careful, in a softer voice, of course, and she'd say sorry, and that would be that. But instead, she looked away and hit the accelerator. "What?" I shouted again. "You're driving away?" Sort of a silly thing to shout, since, of course, that's what she was doing. I shouted some more then. I shouted out her license number, which I could read clearly. That's how brightly lit the corner was. I shouted it several times. I shouted it so she could hear that I'd seen it. I shouted so that I wouldn't forget it. I shouted until I got hoarse. The driver didn't stop driving. I didn't stop shouting until I got across the street, which took me almost to the Salem police station. I made a report, gave the police the license number, and I made sure that the person taking the report got a really good look at my hat. I mean, the whole time I was talking, I might have been doing something like this or kept, you know, pulling the broom. I was very calm by that time, feeling that I was doing just the right thing. I didn't speak with anger at the police department, but I did say, "That driver needs a wake-up call." They asked if I was injured, and I said no. I went home and told my family what had happened. Now I was noticing that my hips were very, very sore, as if they'd taken most of the pressure from the car. I was sorry I'd said I wasn't hurt. My insurance folks might be suspicious if I now claimed that I did need medical treatment after first telling the cops that I was fine. After about a half hour later, I got a call from the Salem police officer who said that the driver had called the station and voluntarily reported the accident. "Good," I said. "That's the most important thing, that she was taking responsibility now. We can have her call you if you want to exchange information for insurance or anything like that." "No." Still, Marla, was that a smart thing to do? I'm asking Marla's an attorney. I don't know. Not too smart. But I said, "No, she's owning up. Just so she's owning up, that's what counts." I was feeling pretty noble, was ready to let the sore hips go since plainly nothing was broken. And then the officer said, "She says she drove off because you were screaming." Screaming? I'd have said shouting. yelling, hollering maybe, but not screaming, and not till after she started driving away, after looking in my face and hearing me say she hit me. The officer didn't have much to say to that except, well, we do caution women not to get out of the car in such situations. I thanked him and hung up. I told Pam what he'd said, and she wondered aloud if the driver would have called the police at all if I hadn't shouted out her license number to let her know that I had it. Maybe not. Probably not. But now that was the least of what concerned me. I was more disturbed than when I'd gotten hit. Something seemed really wrong. And I think I could say what it is, and what bothered me about the word screaming that goes beyond any boy's discomfort that someone might accuse him of screaming like a girl. Gosh, even after being hit by a car. But first let me say that people who've been hurt sometimes holler or even scream. That's because of the pain and the shock and the fear. I don't think that the police really advise anyone to drive away when someone screams after you hit them with your car. But I hadn't screamed. I had yelled. I had shouted in anger, hollered like heck. Yeah, for sure. And now, for sure, I could tell that the driver who had hit me with her car, in some way, in her own mind, she had become the victim in this incident. She was in the car, had all the power of that dangerous instrument in her hands, and it hit me with it. And yet, she was the victim. A few years back, Jonathan Haidt wrote a book called The Happiness Hypothesis. It was marketed as a self-help book, which I usually avoid like the plague. Such books often seem to encourage people to put too many eggs in one flimsy basket. We can solve all of our problems by looking at the birth order in our families, or by eliminating carbohydrates from our diets, or by determining if we are left brain or more right brain. We're urged to find our inner light or our inner child or our inner whatever. Such books come and they go. Everyone's excited for them, by them for a while until in due course they're remaindered and ultimately forgotten. And you can read more about this in my forthcoming book, How to Help Yourself Without Self-Help Books. It's going to be $29.95 hardcover from Bacon Press. But Haidt's book offers some observations on human behavior that are well worth taking to heart. In a chapter called The Faults of Others, he quotes the Japanese proverb that I shared earlier. We see the 7 shortcomings of others, but overlook 10 of our own. And he adds another earthy one from Nigeria. I love this one. A he-goat doesn't realize that he smells. When others do wrong, we are ready to call up our inner judge. When the wrongful action is our own, we are just as quick to place a quick call to what Haidt calls our inner lawyer. He says, one of the reasons people are often contemptuous of lawyers, and my dad was an attorney, I know what he's talking about, is that they fight for a client's interest, not for the truth. For the interest, not for the truth. Although many lawyers won't tell a direct lie, most will do what they can to hide inconvenient facts while weaving a plausible alternative story for the judge and the jury, a story that they sometimes know is not strictly true. Our inner lawyer works in the same way, but somehow we actually believe the stories he makes up. To understand his ways, we must catch him in action. We must observe him carrying out low-pressure as well as high-pressure assignments. I think the driver who hit me with her car had been rehearsing her defense with the cop on the phone, but above all, she'd been rehearsing it with the inner lawyer in her head. To justify first hitting someone with your car, then driving away without offering assistance, apology, or even acknowledgement, I'd say that's a pretty high-pressure assignment. It's very hard to see ourselves as others see us, but let me make a guess about how the driver saw me before she called up her inner lawyer first thing in the morning on the first day of the new year. I'm guessing that she hadn't expected to see me because she hadn't expected to see anyone walking because she never walks anywhere herself anymore, except to reach her car. In spite of my bright fluorescent ridge hat, she didn't see me at all. It's as if I'd been invisible and suddenly appeared out of nowhere just to terrify her. And that hat, on top of my head, above my bearded face. What did she see when she saw that? Someone grizzled, bristly, not fine-featured or young. Who wears a hat like that? A poor fit. Bright green, big letters with no obvious meaning. Probably a poor person. Maybe homeless or mentally ill. Someone who doesn't know anyone, whom nobody would miss. The kind of person you'd find walking, for God's sake, first thing in the morning downtown before it's even light. You pass a lot of them, just a few blocks north by the homeless shelter, milling around, waiting for breakfast. So here's one shouting, screaming, you could say, and I will say it, it's me who's in danger. A real person in real danger, a driver with some place to go, a citizen. Help! A crazy homeless man is screaming at me, just letters and numbers without any meaning. Help! But let me step over to the driver's defense team for a moment. It might have taken her a while to realize that I was shouting out her license number. I might not get it either if someone shouted mine at me, although I might understand if I just hit that person with a car. That nearly happened in 2010. I was driving down State Street in Salem in the leftmost lane, headed to the mechanic before driving out here for Rob Harder's memorial service. There was a lot on my mind. At the rear of the Capitol building, there's a crosswalk in the middle of the block, not at an intersection. My inner lawyer would say that I was not exactly distracted, but I was not fully engaged either. At any rate, I didn't notice that the cars to the right of me were slowing or stopping. I just sailed through the crosswalk, and then I noticed the pedestrian in the middle of it. I didn't hit him or even get that close. He was still a lane away from where I'd driven through, but to tell the truth and not just make a case for myself, I did not see him or notice the cars stopping mid-block because I didn't expect them to. I could easily have hit, injured, or even killed him. As I realized that, my inner lawyer went into action. The vehicle to my right was a big SUV with tinted windows. Several of the other vehicles were also large. How can I see past those elephants and my little ant of a car? It used to be that cars were lower to the ground. There were no tinted windows. You learned to navigate by looking through the windows of those around you, right? And to take in the total picture, and that's how I learned to drive, and that's how it should still be. Etc. Etc. Just what that man's family would love to hear me say in court if he'd lost his life. Yet my inner lawyer had logged on and gone to work just as if that pedestrian had put my life in danger, as if I was the victim. You don't have to be a legal or religious genius to see how. If I had hit him, my life, the life I'm living now, would have come to an end. How could I go on as the father, the husband, the minister, the person I've been? What pleasure could I take in the things that please me now, and the persons, the work, the activities that give my life its meaning? I started talking this morning about how much life can change in a single day, but it can change in a single instant. So much that it's hardly the same life at all. I think we all know this on some level, but we put it out of our minds. I think the woman who hit me with her car was afraid of losing her life. Life as she knows it and holds it dear. And that my shouting increased her fear. My own near miss as a driver in 2010 gave me some closure for what happened on New Year's Day in 2009. I gained new understanding and compassion for that other driver when I saw my inner lawyer, as Jonathan Haidt puts it, log on for action in my interest, but not for the truth. I got a clear glimpse, you could say, of the log in my eye or the elephant on my eyelid. But I still don't regret shouting. You ministers aren't usually shouters. We leave that to the fundamentalists and to Fox News. But if you look on the back of your order of service, you'll see, besides the new arrangement, you'll see that our first principle is respect for the inherent worth and dignity of every person. What does that have to do with shouting? Sometimes you have to raise your voice to get people's attention when it seems that they've taken no notice of you at all or of the others with whom they share the road, the sidewalk, the spaces that are common to us all. The commons. I love that word. I prefer gentle interactions whenever they're possible. I love peace and quiet, but respect for the inherent worth and dignity of every person is a principle that's worth shouting for sometimes. Now, I don't need to tell you that the loudest voices we hear are often shouting for just the opposite, shouting against the worth and dignity of gay people, immigrants, non-English speakers, non-Christians, non-whites. At the same time, they make it sound like they're the ones who are under siege. We're the real victims here. Maybe they think they are. I had thought that I would end this sermon by inviting you to give your inner lawyer a sabbatical this year, because I'm sure he works as hard as mine. But instead, I'd like to invite you to give her something worth representing. If it's something like that first principle or the second or any of the seven, I bet he'll take the case pro bono. That's short for pro bono publico, for the public good. I bet that's good enough for your inner lawyer, and even better for her client. On New Year's Eve, I hope you shouted Happy New Year for this new cycle of days that we all share in common. Happy New Year. Happy New Year, and don't get hit by a car. Don't hit anyone with yours. May you go and come in peace this year wherever you work or play or simply travel. Watch out for splinters, watch out for logs, and don't get squished by your elephant while staring at other people's ants. Not pants, ants. Across the street or way across the sea. Look both ways. When you cross, both ways, you are worth the care. You are worth the care. And so is everyone else out there. Listen to me.